Welcome back to the WebMD podcast. Today we have a very special guest who's going to tell us all about the field of interventional pain management. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Lou. How are you?
Good. How are you, Dr. Webb? Thank you for having me.
No worries. Thank you. First, want to say that congratulations on your recent award at the Women in Medicines. Congrats on that. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a great honor to be awarded that. Lots of experienced women in the field of medicine in San Antonio have gotten that award. So I'm very honored to have gotten that and considered for that as well. But basically, it just kind of highlights women in the community who have served the community of San Antonio, and hopefully we can continue to do more for the people here.
Good. Excellent. And then for the folks out there that may not know who you are, can you just briefly introduce yourself and where you did your medical school residency and training?
Sure. My name is Diane Liu. I did my medical school at University of Texas at the medical branch. I also did my PhD at the University of Texas at Austin, where I studied cell and molecular biology, mostly virology and evolution. So went back to medical school, decided to go into anesthesiology. First, I actually wanted to be an ENT surgeon, so that was where I wanted to go, but then I decided to change at the last minute. So glad I did. Went into anesthesiology, met a lot of interesting attendings in the very beginning of residency, really intern year, who really shaped my path into going into pain. So.
Yeah, and then so you mentioned that you had a late switch from ENT. Was that like fourth year of medical school?
That was right before I applied, yeah.
Wow. And then what was the reason for that switch?
You know, just lifestyle choices, really. Had a boyfriend back then. He was also in medicine, so just kind of thinking about family, career, things like that. I wanted to be in a field where I can still use my hands, but be able to kind of set my own schedule. So anesthesiology was kind of the next pick for me.
Okay. And then you mentioned real quickly your PhD. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And so you went to school to be to get your PhD, and then you worked in that field for a little bit of time?
Yeah. So I did my PhD at UT Austin in Dr. Sarah Sawyer's lab. Did something completely unrelated to medicine. So mostly gene evolution, how primates have evolved to kind of fight off viruses in different ways. And so kind of did my cell and molecular biology training there. And then during medical school and residency, did some more research, kind of focused a little bit on virology and ENT, how HPV affects oral cancers, really, and how that has jumped from cervical cancer to oral cancer. Then when I went into anesthesiology, try to do some cancer research related to pain as well. So try to kind of stay in that genetic realm. But ultimately, I wanted to be more clinical, and so I decided to go into private practice instead.
Yeah, and what would you say you took away from your PhD or kind of your time doing that and into the field of medicine and pain management? Anything you took away that's applicable?
Right. You know, critical thinking, you know, that is the biggest thing. Always questioning why we're doing things the way we are, trying to think, you know, why am I doing, you know, this instead of that? And really just learning more and more as I progress through you know, my practice. And so I think that really changes your mindset on how to think about things outside the box.
Yeah. And do you think that any of the kind of what you were studying and during your PhD in terms of gene defects or people that are more predisposed to having chronic pain, do you think there's association between that?
Definitely. There's genetic factors, there's environmental factors, sex differences, there's multiple different things that can affect the way you experience pain. You know, there's tons of studies done on many different aspects of how we perceive pain. And a lot of those kind of converge into how our brain and spinal cord processes the pain. One person can, you know, have the same stimulus as another person, but the way that we process those pain signals is vastly different. So,
yeah, I definitely agree. I do have patients in my practice that, you know, they come in, maybe it's a motor vehicle accident or maybe it's a fall. The MRIs are normal.
Right.
Yeah, cervical, thoracic, lumbar, but they're having severe pain. And, right. And it's sometimes challenging and, you know, disappointing to tell the patient, I know you've been in pain for all these years. You know, I there's nothing that I can do from a surgical standpoint. What are your thoughts on those patients?
Yeah, I mean, you know, structurally, there might not be any issues that we see on MRI, but that doesn't mean that they're not experiencing pain because pain isn't just an ongoing stimulus. You can have that stimulus be taken away, but once your brain and your spinal cord processes it in a maladaptive way, you can continue to feel that pain even though that stimulus is gone. So that's called peripheral and central sensitization. So, you know, there's tons of people who have experienced something and continue to have pain, but we can't help them because there's, you know, or we don't think that we can help them because there's no or like structural aspect to take care of. But that doesn't mean that they're not experiencing pain for sure. You know, a lot of times when that does happen, we want to focus on other modalities, not just medications, but cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, and trying to retrain your brain and your spinal cord into thinking that, you know, you want to be more functional and having less pain.
Yeah. And how does that come into play a role into your practice? How much of that do you kind of refer patients to? Is that patient comes in that has, let's say some stenosis or tightening, they have pathology in their MRI or imaging studies, but they're underlying, they have that, that's that process, what you were just describing, they may be more predisposed. Mm-hmm. Do you address kind of the imaging studies first and their current complaints and then address the rest later?
Right. So, you know, ideally in a perfect world, you want to address it all at the same time, but unfortunately, it is very hard to access that kind of, you know, behavioral therapy, especially out in the community. And academics is much easier. We have lots of multidisciplinary programs, you know, with the way that psychiatry is going. Unfortunately, a lot of cash-based consultations and things like that, it's just harder to get these patients in the door. And also, it's the monetary aspect makes it harder. So, you know, we can try to manipulate those signals by using antidepressants like Cymbalta, amitriptyline, TCAs, things like that. You know, obviously there's only so much time in the day for me to help, you know, counsel the patients to the fullest extent. So, you know, there are, you know, online support systems that you can, you know, online groups as well that patients can kind of interact with other patients who have been going through the same thing. You know, we're also trying to develop a program where the physical therapists in our physical therapy group can provide some cognitive behavioral therapy type sessions during physical therapy. So that way we can kind of, you know, combine physical therapy with that at the same time without incurring an additional cost. And so there's some that, and that's spearheaded by Dr. Joshi in our group as well. So, there's some innovative ways that we're trying to, you know, change that, but unfortunately, sometimes it's just a barrier.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. And especially as a surgeon, you know, there may be a procedure that is done to address some type of pathology, but at the same time, the patient comes back, their post-op x-rays look fine, their post-op MRI, CT scan looks fine, but they report, you know, continued pain. Right. You know, that's very helpful for me just to think about those other options that are non-injection or non-pharmacological, non-surgical that can help patients.
Right. Yeah. And it's really important. And I honestly should incorporate that more into my practice as well, as I'm sure a lot of other pain doctors feel. but, you know, I think we as a country can do better. It's just the resources are scarce for sure.
Yeah. And then what about like the lifestyle connections, diet, exercise, right, stress? How does that play a role in kind of acute and chronic pain? Right.
So diet is very important. You know, weight loss is important for overall back pain, neck pain, things like that. So lots of patients, you know, they're aware. They know that losing weight can help with a lot of that, especially knee pain, back pain, neck pain. So again, Dr. Joshi spearheads the weight loss and nutrition program here in our group as well. So we're trying to kind of get people more involved in managing their health that way. Exercise, you know, endorphins increase when with exercise. You can actually stimulate changes in your brain, increase the inhibitory signals coming down from the spinal cord in the brain to help modulate pain as well. So exercise is very important in help managing pain. Diet, I've heard a lot of people going on anti-inflammatory diets and they rave about that. Yep. I myself don't know too much about it, but a lot of my patients have been able to like manage their pain and come off opioids just by changing the diet. So lots of lifestyle factors that we don't really think about can really make little differences altogether. So,
yeah, I definitely agree. You know, I have a friend who's a spine surgeon. He really, this was actually a few weeks ago, and I met with him at a conference. He really changed my perspective about patients that come in with pain. So he's a spine surgeon, so he understands kind of disc herniations and radiculopathy and pain and things like that. But he told me that he had some pain in his back one day, just woke up with severe pain in his back, and his pain started shooting down this leg. And he's a pretty stoic and bulky, muscular guy. I mean, he works out like 4 or 5 days a week. He said this is the worst pain that he's ever had in his entire life. He said it felt like somebody was in his leg with a sharp knife going up and down. So it actually led to him calling his sister who lives in Houston, and she could hear in his voice that something was wrong. So she drove 2 o'clock in the morning, started driving from Houston to San Antonio, and he crawled from his apartment to the lobby where someone threw him on their back and took him to get an injection. So, and I looked at his MRI. I've seen worse.
Yeah.
So there's certainly some stenosis, lateral recess stenosis, sure. Little protrusion there. But that really just made me open my eyes and made me just a little bit more considerate when listening to patients describe their pain.
Right.
Because he said he wouldn't wish this on nobody in the world. He ended up getting surgery about 2 weeks later. He had a microdiscectomy.
Gotcha.
So, which ultimately helped. But after hearing that story, I just, you know, I hear patients come in all the time complaining of pain, like, hey, doc, this hurts, but I didn't know it hurt that much.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you see this all the time. You see, you know, MRIs that are pretty similar.
Yep.
One person will come in and you're like, you must be in a terrible pain.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, no, it's like a 3 out of 10.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, that's crazy.
Yep.
And then there's other people who you feel like, okay, that should be manageable. And their MRI isn't that significant, but they're having excruciating 10 out of 10 pain. So the brain and the spinal cord are very, very important in processing those signals. And it's a very powerful thing. And so, you know, a lot of those things that we just talked about, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, diet, all that kind of stuff can really change the way that our brain processes all these signals.
Yeah, and it's certainly a mindset to it, too.
Mm-hmm.
And then what are your thoughts about these alternative pain treatments like acupuncture, CBD, or even like psychedelics, things like that?
Sure. I mean, acupuncture, you know, it's not covered by insurance, so it's really kind of limited to people who are, you know, able to go get that done. But it does actually increase production of endogenous opioids. So there have been studies to show that it can help, and some people swear by it. So I don't think that it hurts. And I know a lot of people who have benefited from it. So I think if you're able to find a good acupuncturist, that's something definitely to try. I think you also mentioned, what was it again?
Like psychedelics or CBD.
Yeah. CBD, you know, there's a lot of things on the market. You know, there's, certain, you know, substrates that have known to that have been shown to help with pain. Not all of them do. So you just have to be really careful. It's just not that well regulated right now. So, but certainly CBD has been shown to help with pain. None of these things, you know, there are extreme examples where people say, oh, it cured my pain, but a lot of them kind of help to some extent, but not completely.
Yeah. Have you ever had a patient that came into your office with, you know, I guess severe pain and you just say, hey, I just can't help you?
It's rare, but it does happen, and it sucks. But they're, you know, they've gone through the whole gamut, and there's really nothing else that I can offer, except for, you know, trying to get them to like a multidisciplinary, you know, program. Unfortunately, you know, those are at the big academic institutions. And so it's hard. Yeah. But every once in a while, yeah, there is someone that I can't help.
Yeah. No, and what about the practitioner surgeons out there that, you know, they come in with a patient that may have some pathology, maybe a disc herniation, they're thinking about surgery, but what are some things that we can look for that, hey, this patient may need something else like cognitive behavioral therapy or need some type of treatment for their underlying depression? Is there anything that can help practitioners just pick up on that?
I mean, I think the more patients you see, you get a gut feeling on someone who is going to actually go along with your plan of care, understand why we're doing the things that we're doing. Those are who are kind of resistant and, you know, who just say, just take my pain away, that might be a little different and more difficult to treat.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the same thing in the spine surgery realm. There's some patients that come in, and I mean, I would say over the last 4 years, I've been able to pick up on patients that may not be surgical candidates, even though they have pathology. They may have some stenosis, or, you know, I just may not be the best surgeon for that patient. So yeah. There are some things that I pick up on over time.
Like coping skills.
Correct.
You know, that's a big thing. You know, I think you can just kind of tell. I don't even know how to put it in words. You can kind of tell.
Yeah. Comes with experience. Yeah. you mentioned the multidisciplinary approach to treating pain. How important is that? And that's kind of using physical therapy, mental health, medication, cognitive behavioral therapy. How important is that?
You know, I think it's very important. We just, I think as in the private practice realm, it's a lot harder, obviously, because we're kind of on an island. And I know I keep going back to academics, but, you know, you have access to lots of different specialties like functional medicine, you know, psychiatry, things like that. So you can kind of send the patients within the system. Like I said, everything, pain is not just, you know, due to a stimulus and a structural event. It's all the brain processing, how you continue to deal with the pain, whether, you know, through medications, exercise, diet, all that kind of stuff, all that comes into play. So I think it's very important. It's just, when you're practicing out on your own, it's hard to kind of form those relationships sometimes. And so once you do form those relationships, obviously you can kind of send your patients to a person who you know is going to take care of them for you. So,
yeah. And do you think there's any role for having a psychologist or psychiatrist inside of a spine practice?
I do. I really do, especially in our group. As you know, we have pain physicians and spine surgeons in our group. And so we also see patients that are outside the spine spine realm. So having those chronic pain patients come in, I think psychiatry would be an immense, you know, asset to the program. Like I said, unfortunately, access to care is pretty limited. Yep. So that's the deterrent there.
Yeah. And then what about some of those newer technologies like neuromodulation, like any of the wearable devices? Mm-hmm. Can you speak a little bit about that? And are you using any of that kind of in your practice?
Yeah. You know, neuromodulation has been around for years. so it's not new, but the technology as it changes is evolving. Certainly there's lots of different companies out in the market now. But, you know, back in the day, you used to be able to feel the stimulation when you had a spinal cord stimulator. And all that, you know, has changed to where you can't feel it anymore, or there's it dynamically changes to movement, things like that. But the idea is that you're telling your brain and your spinal cord not to think about that pain. And I know this sounds like I'm just on a, you know, recording, like playing it over and over again, but the brain and the spinal cord can be very powerful. And we know that neuromodulation taps into mostly the spinal cord and also the brain. And so we can get, like, you know, improvements like 70, 80, 100% relief in pain just by, you know, trying to change the way that we signal things in the brain. So, you know, the idea is the same. The technology is changing and evolving. Spinal cord stimulation for lumbar radiculopathy, post-laminectomy syndrome, and even back pain now has been around for a while. Peripheral nerve stimulation is a little newer, but it still also has been around for a few years now. But the way that we're incorporating them into our practices is different. We do it for knee pain. We do it for a lot of, you know, neuropathies now, shoulder pain, things like that, for people who are maybe not surgical candidates or people who have gone through surgery and continue to have pain, even though everything looks good. So those are kind of the two big things in neuromodulation. There's other things, you know, in pain that are developing that kind of encroach on other specialties as well. But those are kind of newer. And I think kind of the data is still not out there yet.
Yeah. Yeah. And then for spinal cord stimulation or neuromodulation, Can you explain that for patients that may be out there listening, kind of in layman's terms? What is that?
Yeah. So the way I like to explain it, it's like a pacemaker for your back. I think everyone kind of knows how a pacemaker works for your heart. But for the back, you know, we put these leads in. There's some electrodes that go into the spine. It sends signals to your spinal cord based on where those leads end up being, like within the thoracic region. Those signals get sent to this brain and the spinal cord, and it kind of tells your brain not to think about the pain. Instead, it'll give different signals so that you inhibit the pain. So once that kind of gets into your system, and the idea is to reprogram your brain to not think about things that have continuously bothered you. So we can kind of change the stimulation to work with your movements, your activity levels, things like that. If your pain changes later, we can also change the stimulation levels so we can kind of contour it and mimic, or really like, the word, tailor it to your pain as well. So, you know, people who have undergone back surgery, like you said, everything looks good structurally, but they continue to have pain for whatever reason. And it might be because they've had years of pain. And so their brain just won't let it go. We can use spinal cord stimulation to retrain that aspect of pain. So, you know, not just for post-laminectomy syndrome where you've had surgery and continue to have pain. It's for patients who may not be suitable candidates for surgery for whatever reason. Maybe they can't undergo anesthesia, you know, maybe, you know, they just don't want to for whatever reason because of age, things like that. That could be an option. And when we talk about it, we kind of come up with that idea in a multidisciplinary way. That's why I like, you know, love working with our surgeons in our group. They're very mindful about, you know, what could happen during surgery. Is that the best way to go about, you know, helping the patient versus pain management strategies, conservative ways of helping the patient as well?
Yeah. And I would say in your practice, what patient would be like an ideal candidate for a spinal cord stimulator? You mentioned kind of post-laminectomy syndrome, failed back syndrome. What other patients would be a good candidate?
So diabetic neuropathy is one, painful diabetic neuropathy. You know, we have to be a little careful about that patient population because their A1Cs may be high.
Yep.
And so post-op infection, things like that. But, you know, those patients can really benefit from it. You know, spinal cord stimulation has been shown to help with regeneration of those nerves, improvement in sensation, motor function, and also return of reflexes. So some of that can be really, really useful in diabetic neuropathy. Patients who have undergone chemo, that's also another patient subset that we've used spinal cord stimulation for. They, you know, one patient of mine says his feet felt like they're walking on glass the entire time. And then once we put that stimulator in, he's like 70% better. He can walk barefoot. So I find that those patients benefit the most as well.
Yeah. And then how do you differentiate between like lumbar radiculopathy and diabetic neuropathy? How is that kind of clinically diagnosed?
Yeah, I mean, there's way, you know, diabetic neuropathy, it's kind of like stocking glove distribution down from the feet up. You know, you can do like the pinprick tests and things like that. Lumbar radiculopathy kind of starts either in the back or a little lower and shoots down in that way. And it follows a dermatomal distribution. It may be unilateral, maybe bilateral, but diabetic neuropathy tends to be symmetrical, bilateral. You can, you know, clinically also differentiate that by using EMG and CV. That's a useful tool, and that'll pick up on diabetic neuropathy pretty regularly. So, and then like you can kind of just talking to the patient, like the description of pain also really can differentiate the two.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. The primary doctors out there and also spine surgeons, residents, fellows, this is a, educational podcast as well. You're learning today. What are your thoughts about ketamine and using that as a form of pain control?
Yeah. So ketamine, classically, we've used that as an anesthetic, you know, great anesthetic for certain situations, but actually targets the NMDA receptor in a non-opioid way. So we at Vanderbilt, where I trained in residency and for fellowship, we used ketamine a lot in the operating room to use opioid sparing modalities, and also in the pain clinic as well. Low doses of ketamine can actually help quite a bit. NMDA receptor is really, you know, very important for peripheral and central sensitization, which is the higher order processes that help with processing brain signals for pain. So I think that in conjunction with opioids, if you're, you know, even before you use opioids, can be really helpful to minimize opioid use. Unfortunately, it's not covered by insurance. And so we do have to be mindful of the cost, though. But yeah, I mean, it's been shown, it's FDA approved for depression. You know, the higher doses, the nasal sprays are now used for depression. You know, so it really tells you that it really works in the spine and the brain as well.
Yeah, good. And I've had a few patients that I recently sent for kind of ketamine infusions. They're coming in asking for it. So it's certainly something to consider. One of the biggest things I struggle with as a spine surgeon, patients that have pathology, surgical pathology, they may have cervical compression, stenosis. We're planning for surgery. Surgery is not 2, 3, 4 months later just because of scheduling, and maybe the patient has some medical problems that need to be addressed before. This whole idea of kind of weaning them off of their pain meds to help with post-operative pain control. Any thoughts on that, and any suggestions for me to help me get these patients? That's hard.
It's tough. It's tough, right? Because they're in pain, right? We know they're in pain. But if you escalate the doses of opioids right before surgery, it's going to be a lot harder to control afterwards. And so, you know, I think if they're on opioids, the other way to kind of minimize or stop escalation of opioids before you get to surgery is to add other things to help, using a multimodal approach, you know, Tylenol, NSAIDs if they can use it up until a certain time before surgery, obviously, muscle relaxers, gabapentinoids, other things like that. And duloxetine is a good one for, you know, neuropathy, radiculopathy, things like that. I think, you know, trying to, it's a little bit more work because you have to be mindful of side effects and interactions, but it really can reduce the MMEs that a patient, you know, needs for pain control.
Yeah. And is that a good reason to send someone over to you?
Yeah,
just to help with weaning them before surgery?
Yeah, we can certainly do that. I think that's very important. Also, like, you know, most patients don't want to be on opioids anyway. It's kind of their last resort. So they're most of the time they're pretty open to other things.
Yeah. And then what are your thoughts about kind of the stem cells, PRP? I have a lot of patients that come in and say, hey, doc, someone actually just emailed me, said he had some cervical stenosis, a little bit of facet disease. He was asking me about stem cells and what my thoughts were. What are your thoughts?
Well, PRP stem cells, you know, great for joints, muscles, tendons, things like that. For the spine, there are some studies that show that it can be beneficial. But, you know, one of the biggest, you know, possible complications from that, you know, because of the processing itself isn't risk of infection. Obviously you don't want that in the spine or anywhere really, but especially not in the spine. I think there's a time and place for that. Facets are probably not the best. I know a lot of people try to do things for discs, which can be helpful. I know a lot of companies are coming up with biologics like peptides, things like that, to mimic PRP stem cells to try to plump up those discs and help, which may be a more, you know, more, sterile way of doing things, but still, I think the long-term data is not out there. But there is anecdotal data and some few studies, but I think we still have to kind of do our research and due diligence before we kind of recommend it as a something that we should use for ongoing pain relief.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I usually tell patients that you know, if they were my family member, I'm not sure honestly what I would tell my mom and my dad if they asked me, but if it's most of it's cash pay, I believe. Yeah, so that's the thing. If you have a couple $1,000 sitting around, if you want to try it and blow it, I try to lean towards recommending trying other things first. And, you know, if they didn't want to go to surgical route or interventional pain management route, then maybe they can try that.
But, yeah. I mean, like I said, there are certain things that it's great for. I think, like I said, joints, tendons, muscles, things like that. And sometimes surgeons actually use PRP as part of their surgical treatment.
Yep.
And so that can help as well. A lot of orthopedic surgeons will do that. So I think it's still a newer field. Lots of research needs to be done to really know what's really beneficial or not.
Yeah, absolutely. This whole opioid crisis that everybody's talking about, you know, I was doing a little bit of research, kind of reading up on it, and I know it started kind of in the 1990s, I believe, or so, around that area where these pharmaceutical companies were promoting and marketing opioids to physicians and just highlighting or trying to convince them that there wouldn't be any issues. But is that kind of where it started? What are your thoughts about it? And where are we going from here with this whole opioid crisis?
Yeah, I mean, the opioid crisis has changed. I think a lot of people will say there have been three waves of it. So the first one was in the 1990s with the, you know, introduction of OxyContin, which led to like the prescription opioid crisis. You know, we saw a lot of deaths related to overdose and addiction and, you know, abuse really. And so that kind of raised public awareness. Then the next wave has been kind of like the street drugs, the heroin, things like that. And so, then nowadays it's fentanyl. A lot of people are dying from fentanyl overdose. That's, you know, that's kind of like the biggest scare right now. So it's kind of evolved. And so the DEA and, you know, the CDC, WHO, all that, these government agencies are trying to reduce, you know, opioid, you know, consumption and risk of overdose and things like, and abuse really. So it's affected the way that we practice. I know the CDC put out the guidelines a few years ago on how to minimize opioids. Some people kind of took off with it, you know, and followed it to a T. I think they revised those guidelines last year or the last couple of years or so. But, you know, we really should use it as a last resort. There are other things that we could use to kind of mitigate pain before we get to that point. Opioids can actually worsen your pain the longer you use it. It sensitizes your nervous system, creates hormonal imbalances, weight gain, things like that. So lots of other side effects that we don't want. Obviously, you know, in conjunction with other illicit substances can lead to overdose and death. I think the new study, I think from the last year, shows that stimulants like cocaine and other stimulants in conjunction with opioids has led to higher doses, higher overdoses, higher rates of overdose and death. And so it's not just opioids alone. It's in combination with other drugs now. So, and, you know, a lot of people will argue now that the opioid epidemic is mostly fentanyl, street drugs, things like that. But I still, you know, in my practice, we do urine screens all the time, and you'd be surprised to see like the number of illicit substances that come up. And although it might not be prescription opioids that cause a majority of these deaths anyway, but there still are deaths related to that. So I think as practitioners, we should still be mindful. Just because it's not the leading dose doesn't mean that we can't make a difference by, you know, following guidelines, safe practices, and things like that.
Yeah, and I know a lot has certainly changed since I've been in practice for 4 years or even kind of in residency. I just remember we were able to kind of write opioid narcotic prescriptions on paper. They don't allow that anymore. I actually just found a whole book of prescription pass I'd probably need to get rid of somehow, but... Yeah. But yeah, certainly a lot has changed. Is a new rule? Is it 7 days for prescriptions for narcotics?
I think it's like 7 to 10 days for acute pain. Okay. You know, as a chronic pain doctor, for chronic pain, you can write 30-day supplies. You know, for people out there who, you know, aren't sure if opioids are the right thing, just, you know, the best thing you can do is send to a pain specialist. We can be the ones to help navigate that and see, and some people need it, you know, but I think exhausting all conservative measures before you get there is the right thing to do.
Yeah. And you mentioned the kind of urine drug screen. Is that something you have to do at every visit or kind of every 30 days?
We typically do every 3 months to every 6 months, depending on the patient, what kind of opioids they're on, what other medications they're on, especially like benzodiazepines, things like that. So anywhere from, we do twice a year to four times a year, depending on the patient. It's just a safety measure, make sure that we're compliant, we're not overprescribing, you know, and then also to make sure that there's no other risk factors that could lead to, you know, death.
Yeah. And then what about those patients that do come up on their urinalysis, maybe cocaine, marijuana? How do you deal with those patients? What do you do with that?
You know, it's hard because, like I said, cocaine in conjunction with opioids can lead to death. You know, we have to have that conversation. It's a hard conversation to have, but you know, we can, if you decide that it's not the best, you know, care plan, you have to encourage them. We have to wean them off, and send them to programs like New Hope where they can help wean patients off. It's hard because I understand that they're in pain, but we also can't, you know, contribute to their death either. It's a rock and a hard place, unfortunately.
It is. And that was going to be my next question. How do you address this whole opioid crisis while still managing patients that have severe pain? It's a fine balance. I mean, it's hard to do.
Yeah. I mean, we taking a multimodal approach, like I said, NSAIDs, Tylenol, gabapentin, muscle relaxers, interventions obviously can really help. You know, if there is a structural problem, I know, you know, we practice as islands sometimes out in private practice, like I said, but, you know, getting in touch with a spine surgeon, hey, do you think that this patient could benefit from a surgery, like a structural fix? Maybe they'll still be on opioids, but maybe we can decrease that opioid consumption. You know, I think a lot of physicians may be a little apprehensive with all these fields kind of merging and overlapping now, but I think that we need to work together to be able to, you know, come up with ways to help patients. You know, spine surgeries, everyone quotes this 30-30-30 thing, you know, but spine surgery has come a long way. You know, people do really well after surgery. And, you know, a lot of times I don't see these patients ever again after they go and get surgery. So I think there's a lot of like misinformation out there. And, you know, a lot of patients will come to me and say, I don't ever want surgery, but, you know, I've seen patients do well with surgery. So I think as a pain doctor, you just have to realize your limits. And instead of just going to opioids as the last resort, maybe think outside the box and seeing if other people can help, even if you can't.
Yeah, good point. Definitely. Where were you going with this whole opioid crisis? And I keep hearing from various people about having an opioid shortage and we're going to be running out of opioids. Is that any truth to that?
There is some truth to that. There is a quota that, you know, the DEA is setting out where certain companies are only allowed to produce a certain amount. I think the last report said that they expect a 7.9 decrease in opioid consumption and the need for use of opioids in the United States. So, you know, there's a lot of controversy surrounding that. But, you know, in practice, like a lot of my patients will call the clinic saying they're out, you know, the pharmacy doesn't have any, they're out of stock. There's a shortage. So, you know, that's another reason that, you know, we should really be mindful about when to prescribe opioids, you know, even if just because we don't agree with the politics of it, we still have to be able to navigate that. So I think, like I said, minimizing opioids by using multimodal strategies, interventional treatments, multidisciplinary approaches is the best way to go.
Yeah. And then what are some big misconceptions that patients that they may have about pain management that you've heard throughout your practice?
Yeah. the one that I hear a lot is, I thought you were going to fix my pain. You know, 20 years of pain is hard to fix in one session.
I want it go now, doc.
You know, and I think they come to us for a fix. Sometimes it's not going to be a fix. You know, I can't take away the pain, but the goal would be to help you become more functional. And sometimes that doesn't happen overnight. And a lot of times it doesn't happen overnight. So I think, you know, patients have to be aware that it's not just me that's working. It's the patient that has to work for themselves as well. So I need that buy-in from the patient to be able to provide the care that we want to give. So I think that's the biggest misconception when they come to see me. And a lot of patients get frustrated when I say, you know, it's going to take some time.
Yeah, absolutely. Same thing on the spine surgery side of things. Patients come in and say, hey doc, I had a guy come in actually last week and his foot's been weak for about 10 years. He's like, hey doc, can you fix this? I was like, probably not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you have nerve compression, if you think about just putting your elbow on the table and then your fingers go to sleep, you know, when you shake it to kind of wake it up, it takes a little while to wake up. So, I try to explain to patients that's pretty similar to what's going on in your back and the nerves going down to your legs is that when you have compression there and you leave it there for years, that nerve could be damaged and some of that could be irreversible. So in a lot of these patients, I just kind of proceed with caution in terms of operative intervention just because weakness, surgery cannot guarantee resolution of weakness. Their weakness may even get worse. It may not get better at all. So, you know, I think that's why it's important to get seen for your complaints. And some patients may have, you know, difficulty in access of care. But, yeah, it's we try to individualize each individual patient. Just because someone has compression there doesn't mean that we need to operate kind of at every setting, and also from a pain management perspective, that patient doesn't, may not need an intervention. Yeah, so.
Yeah, it's hard. And I understand it. Like, you want it gone. You don't want pain anymore. And I think it might be just societal influences now. So it's difficult. But I think the more that the patients understand that sometimes it's not pain relief, it's functional improvement, that I think the better the outcome.
Yeah. And you spoke about this earlier, but the gender specific differences in how pain is experienced or treated. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, there's lots of studies, especially like fMRI studies that show that different areas of the brain get, you know, stimulated when you get the same stimulus between a male and a female, and also between different age groups as well. So women tend to feel pain more. The threshold is lower than men, you know, although sometimes I don't feel like that's that may be correct, but scientifically it's been shown that women feel pain more. You know, and then you see like diseases like fibromyalgia affects women more than men. So sometimes it can be a little bit harder to kind of overcome those genetic differences with the kind of treatments that we have. And so, but I feel like, you know, I feel like you just have to kind of sometimes play with things to see what's best for each patient. I don't know if you can walk in there and say like, oh, you're a woman. You're not going to respond well to what I do, but everyone's a little different. Just because gabapentin works on one person, it's not going to work on the other. So unfortunately it's like, you just kind of have to test it and try it out.
Yeah, I definitely agree. There's not one size that fits all. And we try to individualize each individual patient in regard to their treatment. Kind of switching gears, you're an anesthesiologist by training. Mm-hmm. Do you miss being in the operating room?
Sometimes. No, I mean, anesthesia, you know, it's a pretty multifaceted field, but there are some moments of anesthesia that I don't miss, like all the high intensity traumas and, you know, like if something starts to go wrong, it can go wrong pretty quickly. So, pain kind of takes that away. I mean, being in the OR, being part of like working with surgeons, the circulators in a group setting, sometimes I miss that.
Yeah. And then, a typical day for you as a interventional pain management, physician, what does a day look like for you?
Yeah, I get to clinic at around 8, usually finish up around 5:30, sometimes as late as 6, depending on how hard the procedures are or how, you know, the difficult the consults are. Usually see patients in the morning in the clinic, new patients, a mix of follow-ups. And then the afternoon, I typically do procedures, a lot of epidurals, lots of ablations as our bread and butter, some peripheral nerve blocks, joint injections, and then a few times a month, the spinal cord stimulators. Do a lot of kyphoplasties in our group as well. We have a fracture prevention clinic. And then, you know, as you know, we do a lot of cementing for the vertebral body fractures. So that's the biggest part of my practice, doing those things.
Yeah. What do you enjoy most about kind of what you do?
I don't know. I feel like it changes. You know, I obviously love doing spinal cord stimulators, but then at some point you're kind of like, I want some variety. You know, Epidurals are very satisfying, right? They're the bread and butter. You got to kind of know your basics about epidurals before you can do anything. That's where I learned like fluoro and all that stuff. So those can be hard too, as well, especially with the patient population that we see a lot of spine patients. And so those can be challenging too. So I feel like it changes every day.
Yeah. And then I guess this is for the students out there or aspiring pain management anesthesiologists, any advice you would have for them?
Yeah. I mean, get lots of exposure. In residency, you know, you're not going to become good at doing pain interventions and doing all that, but that's what fellowship is for. In fellowship, I really put my all into it, learning every aspect of it, learning how to work the C-arm, you know, trying to understand what my attendings were thinking about when we did the advanced procedures, like asking lots of questions, really trying to envision in my head what's going on with the procedures. Like the hardest part is developing like a three, as a surgeon, you yep. probably know that, trying to develop like a 3D picture in your head using 2D images. And so I think that was the biggest hurdle to overcome. But once you kind of understand how things work, it's really fun.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. And it's constantly evolving. There's a lot of new technology, robotics, computer guided navigation, augmented reality that in the field of spine surgery, it's revolutionizing right. kind of how we practice medicine. Right. You've been in practice for 3 years?
2 years.
2 years. Okay. Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. What's been the most challenging in terms of that transition from fellowship, residency to being an attending? What's been the most challenging?
Yeah. You know, as a resident and a fellow, you always have that backup. Like yep. the attending is always there to save the day. Now you're the attending. And so trying to overcome the fear of making the wrong decision has been the most challenging thing. But you learn from your mistakes and then you learn from your successes too. So I still struggle with that sometimes. You know, once you get it into your groove, you kind of get used to a certain thing and then maybe it doesn't work for somebody or there's a complication that kind of really makes you rethink everything. I still keep in touch with my attendings, asking for advice all the time, you know, no matter how stupid it is anymore. So I think just constantly reevaluating yourself, learning from your mistakes and also your successes is the key to being independent.
Yeah, it's the same thing as a surgeon. Yeah. Just, you know, everybody's going to have complications. Right. Everybody's going to have mistakes. I mean, I've struggled on certain cases, and I've learned from those. Right. So after every case or a mistake or complication, I try to sit back and analyze, ask myself, what could I have done differently?
Right.
And how can I use this to be a better surgeon, better doctor in the right. future? So, and you've built a pretty successful practice, really busy practice in the last 2 years. Right. What do you do outside of medicine? What's your outlet to medicine in terms
gosh.
Of,
yeah. I wish I had an outlet right now. I have two young kids. Most of it is just kind of, you know, watching them grow, being a mom and a person really.
Yep.
I would like to pick back up on reading because I don't know about you, but reading all through medical school and fellowship and residency, I was just burnt out on reading, but I used to love to read. Yep. So it's something I want to pick up on again. But you know, I think the important part is to not let medicine consume you.
Yep.
You get burnt out. You know, it's just, you don't want that to be your identity.
Mm-hmm.
So, especially with kids, and a family. So,
yeah. How do you find that balance? Cause I struggle with that. Oh, luckily my wife stays at home with our little ones and can help out quite a bit, but I can't imagine, you know, you're married to a physician and you're a physician yourself. Yeah. I just, any tips for parents out there that are physicians?
It's hard. It really is. If you have family, that's great. Yeah. Family is really important and helpful. I think my husband, you know, he is very understanding. I probably tend to be more focused on my work than he does.
Yeah.
So he's understanding when I'm like, I can't do this today.
Yeah.
So having that support system with your partner, I think is really important. But I think you also have to be able to let things go. Sometimes you can't be perfect at everything. And so, it's hard. I wish I could give better advice.
Yeah, I'd imagine physician being married to another physician is probably a little bit easier. My wife's nowhere near the medical field, and I mean, just having that understanding, hey, I got to do this. There's a lot of behind the scenes things that have to be done to even prepare for clinic for procedures, operative reports. Right. I mean, billing, there's a lot of things that go unlooked. So,
I mean, there's times at night after we get the, put the kids to bed, we're just like working on our computers side by side. That's, you know, it's like, even though we're not talking, it's like, you know, there's a support system there because I know I'm not the only one that's up and up late working. So we do a lot of work together at night. He does his work and I sit next to him and do my work. And we coordinate times. If he, I know his Wednesdays are bad. So I try not to be late or take care of the kids in the morning and for his Wednesdays. And I'll let him know like, hey, I'm in this clinic. I'm going to be far away. It's going to be a really long day. And so he'll try to adjust his schedule and vice versa. So it, it takes a lot of communication for sure.
Yeah. And where do you see the next kind of 2 to 5 years in practice? Any plans, any, you have anything planned?
Oh, I mean, I still want to stay busy. We're trying to add more physicians to our group so that we can, you know, grow and expand, taking on more of a little bit of a managerial role in our clinic right now. So hoping to, you know, guide these new physicians so that we can practice good medicine and help people in San Antonio.
Yeah. And where can people find you if they wanted to see you as a patient, if they wanted to refer patients to you, where can people find you?
You know, you can refer to South Texas Spinal Clinic. You can give us a call. I go to 3 different locations, but you could, there's a main line you can call. You can also set up an appointment off the website. Those are usually the easiest way.
Okay. And I'll put that information in the description, but, Dr. Liu, thank you so much for coming on. Every conversation podcast that I do, I learn something new. So, you know, I'm gonna go home and refresh up on diabetic neuropathy and, how that usually presents, but thank you for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
It's especially, just been really good just watching you come in and just blossom into a really great physician. And I speak very highly of you to patients and, wish you kind of, great luck in your next couple of years into practice and continued growth.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And everyone else, thank you for listening in for this episode of the WebMD podcast. Make sure you check the description for links to Dr. Liu's practice and her the website, as well as to other show episodes. And we'll see you in the next one.